It's estimated that 300,000 people in New Zealand live with untreated hearing loss. Ageing accounts for a percentage of that, and another undetermined percentage is because of exposure to noise. The market for noise-cancelling headphones is already worth more than $13 billion, and it's thought sales will treble by the end of this decade. We search for silence more and more, even when the noise we're exposed to doesn't diminish our hearing. Our work suffers on a daily basis. People even find it's easier concentrating when they take their laptop to a noisy cafe, actually, rather than in an open plan office. We see earbuds and headphones everywhere now, and it's not just because people are listening to music. Just as cell phones were marketed originally to women for their personal safety back in the 90s, noise-cancelling headsets were originally designed only for aircraft cockpits, and now, reports The Guardian, they're even being marketed as desirable if you have children to avoid parental burnout. But there are downsides. Dr. David McAlpine is a globally recognised research leader in auditory sciences. He's the Director of Hearing Research and Professor of Hearing, Language and the Brain at Macquarie University in Sydney. David, very good of you to join us.
Thank you very much. Lovely to be here.
Especially with tonsillitis, which I won't go into detail of, but I appreciate you joining us in the middle of, slight incapacity.
As long as people can hear, it's not a problem.
Good. I suppose we should start by explaining how noise-cancelling tech works, because not all of us will know how it works, I think.
So noise-cancelling is really about predicting and knowing what the noise background actually is. And one of the problems with noise-cancelling technology is that it decides. Many of these modern algorithms, particularly in hearing aids, have beamforming algorithms where they have multiple microphones, and they generally say that if the microphones are pointed in the direction forward, which they assume is where you're listening, then all the sounds that are not directly in front of you, and they're assuming the in front of you is another talker, they're cancelled out, they're removed, they're scrubbed. And that's a big assumption. At a party, you may be watching or looking at someone, but you may be listening off to the side. So a noise cancelling beamforming algorithm that cancels out signals will be cancelling out the stuff you want to eavesdrop on. So what we mean by noise, how we cancel noise, and what decision-making is there to decide what is noise and what is signal is actually quite opaque.
The noise optimally cancelled, I understand, from headphones or whatever, is low frequency, like traffic or a helicopter flying overhead or a loud air con, stuff like that.
That's exactly right. When you have fluctuating sounds, you can and they're slowly fluctuating, you can get rid of them by having an inverted copy because some of them are predictable, some of them can be tracked more easily. If they're very rapidly fluctuating, it becomes very difficult to get rid of them because of that rapid fluctuation. It's hard to predict them, it's hard to know where they're going, and it's hard to do it quickly.
Understood. There are upsides. I mean, every barista in a cafe should be wearing them. I've often thought of that in cafes.
It's a major issue for the gig economy, bluntly. If you think of the gig economy as riding on a bike in traffic or working, as you say, as a barista, the noise at work regulations probably don't extend to cafes. Yet a tiled wall surface, the noise of the espresso machine, the music you've got on, and the din of 40 people will be challenging your hearing. In fact, it will be probably as loud as the work on the construction site that you walk past, or the train that may be making a lot of noise from the carriages or from the driver's side. So there is a huge amount of noise in work settings that are modern work settings that is not seemingly regulated in the way that we regulate factory work and the way that we regulate the industrial noise exposure of construction sites, for example.
So people, I know people who work in cafes, so is their hearing at risk, basically, from the noise of the coffee machines over a prolonged period?
Their hearing is definitely at risk because noise, and by that I mean loud sounds, we use the term noise, but we actually mean intense sounds, could be anything. It could be Taylor Swift, and it was Taylor Swift here in Sydney for four nights in a row. Loud sounds damage your hearing. All of these gig economies and other places are essentially high-risk listening environments that are damaging your hearing, and at an early age, if you're a barista.
How about if you're a bus driver? How serious does that affect over a prolonged period of time in a big city with lots of noise as you drive?
The interesting thing about noise exposure and the noise at work regulations, etc., is that they were fitted to another time. They really were the 8 hour, 5 day a week working environment for industry. And the levels of noise exposure associated with having to be protected was that above a certain level, 80 something decibels, 82, 83 decibels, you have to halve the amount of time you can safely listen for every 3 decibel increase. So as you go from 82 to 85, you might go from 8 hours to 4 hours safe exposure. And that was built into the noise at work regulations, I would say at a global level. I mean at a developed economy global level, certainly not in developing economies. And that has set the agenda for what we think noise exposure at work is. But there are two other factors. The first is the accumulation of noise that is maybe not as damaging or perceived as damaging for as long, may actually be more as damaging. We now are getting to the view that this low level 85, 90 decibels, which in fact at work you wouldn't be allowed to experience for longer than a couple of hours by 90 decibels, that is damaging you in a way that isn't always evident in your hearing tests, the classic audiogram. Noise damage used to be thought to be damaging the little sensory cells that pick up quiet sounds. You lose your hearing, you need a hearing aid, it amplifies sound to try and help you hear better. We now think that noise exposure, cumulative noise exposure, or it damages the little nerve endings that connect those sensory cells to the brain so that you have a listening problem, can't understand speech even when you can hear it before you get a hearing problem. And that's not factored in at all. And so the levels of exposure that you would have as a bus driver, for example, may well be enough not only to do that, but also enough to do other things we think about noise now, which is damaging your heart. So we know that low-level noise exposure, well below the level that we actually think damages your inner ear, causes an increase, results in an increase in cardiac events. There's clear evidence that nighttime noise exposure as well, even if it's 65, 70 decibels, which shouldn't be anywhere near damaging your inner ear, is actually increasing the risk of heart attacks and cardiac events as well. For every decibel it goes up, there was something like a 1% increase in cardiac events. And that is a huge difference. That's noise affecting your life in a way that isn't affecting your hearing.
Yeah, it is. Interesting you mentioned hearing tests because I come up with a clean bill of health in them, but I know that I've got one ear that doesn't hear as well as the other, and yet the tests don't reveal that. In fact, they deny it.
That's called hidden hearing loss. I would say immodestly, I coined the term hidden hearing loss just over a decade ago for exactly this. So we were exploring in a scientific research study in London when I was still there at University College London, looking at normal hearing, so audiometrically, pin drop hearing normal listeners who experience tinnitus. And for that group of people with tinnitus, compared with an identical group but without tinnitus, they had elevated brain activity that you could measure objectively associated with their tinnitus. And yet they had absolutely normal hearing. And we call this form of listening problem, whether it's tinnitus, hyperacusis, which is elevated sensitivity to louder sounds, or this I can't understand speech and noise problem. I can hear it, but I can't understand it. Hidden hearing loss, because it really isn't available or diagnosable by the standard audiometric tests. That makes some sense. Standard audiometry is there to, bluntly, sell hearing aids. Hearing aids amplify sounds to make them louder, but they don't make them more distinguishable. But the benchmark for fitting a hearing aid is the audiogram. And so it makes sense to some degree that, oh, that's fixed the problem, and we get the hearing aid. I'd also unfortunately, like I say, there's no other therapy. You get a hearing aid, or if you're very profoundly deaf, a cochlear implant, there's nothing else on the shelf at the moment.
You perceive a paradox, I think, or an irony, whatever the word is, in the fact that the same companies sell these devices and they're also selling headphones that can make us deaf if we turn them up too loud.
Yes, so there is an irony associated with having technology companies moving into the hearing therapeutic space at a time when they're actually providing the sorts of devices that can damage your hearing early on. And from early in development and at school, some children have listening problems in those sort of complicated environments. There are boosts and tools and technologies for helping that, and that's really a good thing. But if we don't temper our exposure using devices, headphones, earbuds, then we really are at risk of needing the hearing therapeutics and devices earlier and earlier in our life. And the same companies seem to be involved in delivering both of those.
So just summarising before we carry on, hearing loss creeps up on us and actually the damage can be hard to detect clinically.
Yes, that's right. We shouldn't really be thinking about hearing loss this way, because when you get an eye test, for example, you go and you have to look at letters. Now, presuming you can read, you don't need to read more than one letter at once, but that's a functional test of your hearing, of your vision. You're not asked to relate things to how bright they are, but in hearing, we're not asking you to have a functional hearing test. We're presenting a tone in quiet and then asking you to detect the quietest sound of a tone that you can hear, which is not a functional listening assessment at all. It's actually a test of the detection of very, very quiet sounds in very, very quiet environments, which isn't most people's problem. You don't go to the pub and then leave 5 minutes later because it's too quiet and you can't hear tones. You go to the pub because it's too noisy and you can't follow a conversation that you could follow when you were at home. So that really is a strange way of thinking about how we assess hearing, because what you really want to know is, can I hear at the pub? And can I converse at a family gathering? And does the telly getting turned up actually make a difference to whether I can hear the dialogue against the music? Those things ignored. And yet, those are the main things people complain about.
Okay. Well, how much does that matter when the TV you're listening to is competing with other noises in the house, just out of interest?
Good point. It is actually one of the major complaints, usually from a partner. You're turning the telly up too loud.
Yes.
But it's too muddy. And of course, there's been a lot of chit-chat about the muddy nature of modern cinema and television with respect to the dialogue is not easy to understand. One of the challenges there, of course, is that all the tech companies who make fantastic audio equipment and settings deliver those sounds in very bespoke settings and try them out and show how great they are. And then they come to your television with the terrible speakers or your room acoustic, which is fully reverberant and has hard walls and hard floors. And you just get all the reverb and the echo and you can't hear what they can hear in their plush cinema setting where they've presented this in front of a whole bunch of audio engineers. So that's a challenge. But we also have that challenge that we might be in a situation where people, you know, Gen X people and others are saying, well, actually, this sounds muddy, but it's actually not the muddy nature of the audio production. It's the muddy nature of their hearing.
Yeah.
We're getting hearing or listening problems earlier than we might have in the past outside the work situation.
What does constant earplug wearing do to us? I wear them sometimes at night, you know, for the police helicopter or if the neighbours are having a party or whatever. But I was reading it doesn't take long to have an effect on us wearing earplugs.
Yes, that's true. Earplugs are interesting because some people really do rely on them. I live in the centre of Sydney near the Harbour Bridge and near a major road construction for the last 18 months. I don't really worry too much about that sort of noise. I can hear my children, especially a couple of years ago when they were very young, at the drop of a hat. You can pick up sounds that mean something to you, but sounds that are meaningless or become meaningless because they're just constantly there can fade into the background. Yeah. Some people need earplugs, but earplugs aren't actually necessarily good for you. We do know that if you block out sounds that are supposed to be heard, you can get an elevation of your brain gain, as it's called. It's a bit like the internal volume knob of the brain isn't picking up all the sound levels it thinks it should be, and it turns up the volume internally and increases the gain. That may be one driver of tinnitus, and in fact, there's good evidence now that if you deprive people of normal hearing by wearing earbuds constantly for a few days, they really start to experience tinnitus, the ringing in the ears, which is the brain saying, oh, I haven't got enough sound energy coming through. I better turn up the volume knob internally because something's not coming in, and you experience this, perception of sound when there's no sound out there. So ear plugging doesn't necessarily help. And the same with ear or noise cancelling headphones. We've got to understand that we are connected to our environments through sound, not just the sounds we actively perceive, but also the sounds that impact on our ears, which we kind of ignore, but actually help us understand the room, help us listen to others, help us learn the environment we're in so we can communicate better. And getting rid of that by assuming it's noise as opposed to something our brains have dealt with for millennia in order to communicate better is not good either.
And our brains have also dealt with the problem of sleeping for millennia. So I presume if you put earplugs in to sleep, you mightn't actually be sleeping that better because we've evolved, to actually have our brains switch off in layman's parlance, when we lie down and try and, have a nap.
That's a really good perspective, and actually an interesting question for us as researchers at Macquarie University. The Woolcock Institute, which is about sleep, has just joined the university as a medical research institute, very interested in sleep, but also then interested in those things that intersect with sleep. So ADHD, attention deficit hyperactive disorder, but also things like tinnitus and other light or poor sleeping perspectives that may be driven by a whole so all sorts of behaviors that are not to do with sleep per se. And listening and attenuating your response to sounds is probably going to be less effective if you are earplugged the whole time. So if you're used to being ultra quiet, does noisy make any noise suddenly make you a poor sleeper? And yes, we've been sleeping for a long time, literally. A lot of our life is spent sleeping. And some people have very poor sleeping habits. So it's actually an interesting topic for us at the moment. How do people experience the sound world when they're asleep? Because we know we don't have ear lids. Our ears are always on. Our listening brain is always active and ready as an early warning system. And when we sleep, a lot of animals sleep with one eye open or half an eye open. But if you don't sleep with half an eye open, you've got your ears fully open. And that is evolutionarily important. And it may actually be homeostatically important too, so physiologically important for your brain to have sound information in there at night as well.
Yeah. Dr. David McAlpine is with us, the Director of Hearing Research and Professor of Hearing, Language and the Brain at Macquarie University in Sydney. One tricky aspect here is that moderate ambient noise actually enhances productivity, doesn't it, for many people?
Interestingly, there's a lot of jury out perspectives on what those noises are and whether they're helpful or not. So one issue that we've been exploring recently is neurodivergent listeners, listeners who have maybe autistic people on some part of the spectrum, adults, people with ADHD, and their perspectives of noise and ambient noise, background noise, and their ability to listen and work in that is very different to a neurotypical individual. And neurotypical individuals vary as well, depending on their hearing function. So having ambient noise may drown out the babble of other people talking or intrusive noises that are disturbing your work, but they may also impact your ability to concentrate. They may be intrusive. They may be alarming for some people. So ambient noise, to some degree, is very personal. And whether you like it or don't depends upon a whole range of factors. One of the things, of course, that it's arisen from is open plan offices. Even if you weren't experiencing ambient noise before, you have no choice. Everyone's in the same office space, and there's a general babble, often in environments where people are using the phone or on Zoom calls. Even if they're wearing headphones, there's a general babble level that, unless you're sealed in as well, will be distracting. And we know that babble noise, multiple talkers at once, is one of the hardest, most cognitively challenging situations to listen in. Even for the same level of understanding, babble noise is much more cognitively engaged, we think, than just white noise, that sort of hiss noise, at the same intensity and the same performance level. So there's something about our ambient background that isn't necessarily ambient, depending on what it is and who we are.
Yeah, that's very interesting to hear. I saw a proposal that yes, these days we do have open collaborative environments, and we probably can't imagine what it's like without them now. But we also need rooms, as in the old days. You go into your own office where the noise is reduced and you get more work done. I don't suppose we're going back there, though.
Well, anecdotally, I think maybe there is some evidence. People work less and are less collaborative when they think everyone's in earshot. There's nothing about going in and opening a door, even if it's a glass office, and having a conversation that is directed, purposeful, and not interfered with by all other sources. And our natural tendency, because we're evolved animals with all the fear, fight, flight, food, all those sort of things that drive our brains, to wonder what other people are thinking about our conversation. And particularly at the moment, in the modern life that we have, what we say, how we say it, and to whom we say it are actually big factors in our social engagement and our social acceptance. And so our whole communication sphere is upside down, really. We have driven our communication modes and the way we operate to accommodate what technologists and businesses and environments and profit margins say we need or they need for us, when in fact that's the wrong way of thinking of communication and listening. If you're constantly having to compete with other people for that territory, then it can be very difficult to not use the technology that isolates you from everyone else.
And hot desking, which employees tend to hate, and their morale and productivity suffer, I see in studies, but there's no sign of that being done away with. And so would it be fair to say that modern work environments are becoming untenable, that is creating too much uncertainty and stress as well as the noise?
Yeah, I actually think the noise is probably the most intrusive one, because as I mentioned earlier, you don't have ear lids and your eyes are at the front of your head. You can't see behind your head because you don't need eyes behind your head. You've got ears. And so your ears are always open and always picking up all of this information, which is a good thing in many ways. And evolutionary wise, people creeping up on you or animals creeping up on you or whatever was, this is why we have this 360 degree hearing. But it's always on. And intrusion is always coming from noise. And we know this is the case. And we know that visual intrusion is less likely. And we also know that people wouldn't accept the level of intrusion into the visual system that we experience and seem to have to accept for our hearing. Noise is, it's just noisy. Oh, there's just a party. Oh, that was a very loud concert and I've lost my hearing for 2 days. I mean, you wouldn't go to a gig where they were beaming dangerous laser lights into your eyes for 2 hours and then come away and say, how was the gig? Oh, great. I couldn't see for, the next 2 days. That would never happen. And yet we allow intrusion of sound all the time. And if we put up with it, we put up with it disgruntledly, would be the term.
Yeah. I think you postulate a fanciful scenario by way of analogy where we all put on virtual reality goggles to make the world look beautiful, with headphones to make it sound better as well. And then we wouldn't need to spend any money on our civic environments. The middles of our cities might be an awful shambles, like your construction site, but they'd seem fine during the workday, and we could take the goggles and headphones off once we arrived home in the suburbs.
Now, that film's already been made. It was called The Matrix, wasn't it? I mean, essentially,
that's right.
We're all sitting there, and the tech companies are sucking our what we're listening and hearing and seeing into their, large computers and selling it back to us as VR and AR. And it is actually, it's a maybe a trite perspective, but it's actually a good point. What we hear and what we listen to and how we engage with our sound environment should be owned by us. It shouldn't be owned by others. And we know that's the case when we think about hearing aids and cochlear implants, phenomenal devices to support people with hearing problems. They don't record what you're listening to. They record the sound levels you're listening to, and they presuppose that it may be in a cafe or a home environment, and they adjust the settings to help you listen. No one wants what they're hearing and saying broadcast all over the place. And that perspective, where we've narrowed down our sound environment to some degree into ourselves, and where it's been commodified and sold back to us, including through natural language processing, which is, been sold as generative AI, and an artificial intelligence, or an intelligence itself. That is bizarre that we've allowed that to happen and commodified it without, we wouldn't want our neighbors to hear what we're saying. And yet, we're letting Mark Zuckerberg and colleagues hear what we're saying and selling it back to us. It seems bizarre.
And I'm older, but when I see all the cans and buds that people are wearing, I see people who are kind of slaves to the machine as well.
I think we're in that space.
I was reading an opinion piece on Fast Company online about sound therapy to deal with stress, given that so many people now seem to be in permanent states of fight or flight in certain working environments. And a recent report from Bloomberg, I noticed, claims that white noise and ambient sound podcasts consume 3 million hours a day on Spotify, and it's a growing trend. Sound therapy presumably has ancient origins, and it's, in all sorts of ways. People say that it works. Do you think it works and the effect lasts?
Does sound therapy work? I think it's part of the wellness UBU perspective. I think it's different strokes for different folks, and I think that's important. But some of the things that are being claimed or have been claimed about sound therapies aren't true. So one of those is binaural beats, which is a tone of low frequency tones, one in each ear, and they're slightly different frequency. And I've used these all the time in hardcore scientific experimentation, but they essentially generate a sort of a rotating sound. It's a tonal sound that moves between your left and sets to your right ear and between your left and ear. It sort of rotates inside your head. And it was claimed that somehow this provided enhanced cognitive abilities for attention, for education and stuff. Recent studies shown that, in fact, it does exactly the opposite. It actually makes cognitive performance poorer. That makes some sense. It may make you feel relaxed, and white noise might make you feel relaxed. But if you had something else to do suddenly, or even contemporaneously the whole time through that, there's no such thing as a free lunch. When your brain energy is given over to something else, then the things you need to do pay a penalty. You pay the penalty even then and there, which is, the air traffic controller. How much do you want them not paying attention to what's going on the screen and the vision in front of them? Or you pay the penalty by being exhausted by the end of the day and not going out for the social function you were going to, or just isolating yourself. There's always a penalty when you're listening. And the difference between ambient sound that chills people out when they're doing nothing, I mean, that's basically distracting them from their thoughts. But if it's a distraction from your actual day-to-day work or your livelihood or your safety, then it's, in my view, not something you should be messing around with.
Look, I know this won't apply to everyone, and it's an airy-fairy sort of question, but there is surely something badly wrong with current living that people have to escape its basic aspects. I mean, do we need a rethink of the societies we have created and are creating?
It's something I think about all the time, particularly in this perspective that the world's got louder. And we're trying to deal with the louder world, and we can't keep our noses or our ears above the waterline, because we have accelerated this way, and we don't have an ergonomic, I would hesitate to use the dad joke, ergonomic perspective for how we've constructed our environments. And we retrofit our sound systems, we retrofit our noise cancelling. We don't spend the money, and we know that architecture always gets waylaid. Architectural and ergonomic, oral architecture gets waylaid by cost. So when the first thing to go on the budget line is the sound environment and the exploration and damping of noise, you can just hear a motorcycle roaring past my window, open as it is. When the first thing to go in the budget line is a noise assessment, then you know that a building could be acoustically ill. It could make people feel physically unwell because of the sound. So how have we thought about how we structured our society to accommodate our listening? We haven't, which is why at a Taylor Swift concert, and I have no truck to bear with her music, I don't know her music, four concerts in a row in Sydney, 250,000 people there, sound levels in excess of 105, 110 decibels, there'll be a number of people, quite a lot of people will leave that concert having gained, quotes, tinnitus ringing in the ears for the rest of their life. That's not to pass judgment on popular music, it's to say we haven't even got that right. And that will be someone in their teens now experiencing tinnitus for the next 60, 70 years.
God,
And
that's a stark
dreaming about it.
revelation. Oh, okay. Gee, okay. I just
And
want to.
I'm not taking the anti-Taylor Swift view
No, I
here.
know.
I know nothing about music.
No, I know. It could be anybody with that kind of concert. Look, I suppose just to sum up it right at the end, I mean, I was reading a piece in Noema magazine about the effects of our acoustic environments now on birds. And chronic noise stressing birds, and their voices are louder as they try to make themselves heard over traffic, and they sing louder on weekdays, you know, when it's noisier. And I was thinking, as we all would when reading that, okay, that's the birds. How about us?
Well, birds have got it lucky. I can hear them twittering in the tree outside, and I walk across the freeway here over the bridge to North Sydney CBD, a few minutes away. And the cacophony of birds in the evening there is phenomenal. One of the noisiest things you will hear. And you hear it above and beyond the freeway. They're definitely shouting louder. But we've got to remember, birds evolved to restore their hearing because they shout loudly. Budgerigars, an Australian bird, are amongst the world's top 10 noisiest birds. They flock in their thousands. And yes, they're talking louder or singing louder. I think they're used to it. They're used to it. We know they're used to it because they regenerate their inner ear. If you make a bird deaf, it regenerates its sensory cells in its inner ear so it can hear again, because they needed this hearing not just for survival as they were born, but they needed it for reproduction. There was an evolutionary pressure for birds. They had to sing for their supper. They train their young to sing their song to find a mate. And they are territorial and use bird song as marking out their territory. In fact, a lot of birds have very narrow bandwidth of sounds that they generate. That means they're like tones. And tones are notoriously difficult to locate. So a bird is basically saying, all this area you can hear this tone, that's mine. And so birds regenerate their inner ear. So they may have strategies for coping. But it's a pretty stressful life, probably anyway, as a bird, and they regenerate their inner ear because they've always dealt with noisy environments. The urban jungle is probably not much louder than the jungle, and may even be quieter because of birds. Birds are noisy.
Well, maybe we're more resilient than we think as we move into the seemingly scary age of even more noise.
We think about it in this way that humans haven't got tough hearing because they procreate before they go deaf. And so this is the opposite to birds. So, Mick Jagger's 80 and whatever, and so are his fans. So, the Taylor Swift perspective for concert noise is not related to age. But we now spend at least half our lives with a serious communication disorder because of our hearing. So when you died 10 years after leaving the factory, you had 10 years of hearing impairment that wasn't at work, but you had multiple years of hearing impairment. But now, if you live to be 100, you're going to be hearing impaired and a communication disorder for half your life. And that is a problem that we've never faced up to. Hearing loss in midlife is the single biggest modifiable risk factor for a later dementia diagnosis.
This is sobering stuff. Well, thank goodness you're doing your research on it, but there don't seem to be any clear remedies in view, do there?
Well, there's some light on the horizon, I would have to say. Therapeutics and a gene therapy now has gone into a number of kids in an early clinical trials, and it's restored their hearing. That's phenomenal. That is a big story. It's strangely the easy win because the other forms of hearing loss that you get that damage the sensory cells are much, much harder to target. But now we have a gene therapy that has explored and now is restored in a pilot population of kids their hearing function. We've never had that before. We've never had a pill for hearing. And so a pill for hearing might be one that protects you when you go to the gig. A pill for hearing might be one that you actually take after you've been to a noisy place or a concert that actually restores the cells in your inner ear before they start to go into this journey into damage. Or it might be a gene therapy that you give in utero when we know that, childhood hearing loss, that is genetic, is one of the big factors in all hearing loss before age-related hearing loss. and you get in utero gene therapy that means you're not born deaf. Those are on the horizon. And I would say for the first time, seeing gene therapy for hearing loss being given is actually fantastic. And we ourselves are collaborating with colleagues in our commercial partners and our university partners with a gene therapy combined with a cochlear implant in older adults to improve their function of their cochlear implant by restoring their nerves more closely to the implant device. Those sort of things are Star Trek, but they are potential future communication, get out of jail free cards, if you like.
Yeah, no, that's a lovely note to end on. Great to talk with you, David, and to have all that information, good and bad. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much. Enjoyed it a lot.